colleges of all.
There were something else.
I'm going to give a very quick intro.
Okay, thank you so much.
Sure. Well, good afternoon and welcome to the Seeker Center. My name is Matt Grieger and I'm an assistant director here at the center. Thank you all for coming. I know it's hard to attract a huge crowd on Laos, so I'm glad to see those who we have here. I can tell you, I remember last spring when we actually received this proposal. We were so excited to get something on Laos that unless it was a horrible proposal, and luckily yours was excellent, it was sort of, you know, we were definitely going to fund it. Because, of course, in this city, unfortunately, there's, you know, a lack of much understanding, or especially new research on Laos, and so we were very happy to see this proposal. And luckily for all of us, it was very well done, and so we were very happy to fund it. So obviously, you know, anyone who knows anything about Southeast Asia, you know, sort of mainland, highland Southeast Asia, sort of, you know, issues in the forest, conservation, you know, timber, all of this are extremely important, controversial issues. You know, FDI in Laos, I've seen quite a bit on CSIS, has started to do some things. So this is very timely. I'm happy you're here, and we look forward to hearing what you have to say.
Thank you very much, Matt. And first, I would like to extend my special thanks to the Seeker Center for funding this research. I've been really interested in forest for quite some time, and I'm grateful of this opportunity. And I also want to thank a number of professors at the LA School who gave me very useful advices, and as well as an anonymous NGO at the ground who facilitated my research. Actually, I didn't have any authorization from the government to do the research, so they actually took me as their intern. So I went there undercover and I did the research, something that they were also interested in. So we were kind of doing some local partnerships together. So this research was really made possible by the cooperation of a number of a great number of people. And today, here's my agenda. I would like to tell you a story of a village where how the rubber plantations came in, and how the land has been acquired, and what is the outcomes as a result. And I also want to provide some preliminary assessment of the impact. It's very difficult to do impact assessment of forestry because a lot of environmental and economic impacts are very long term. It only manifests itself in 10, 20, 30 years afterwards. So I want to do some preliminary assessments on that, and also because this research is partly due for this NGO who facilitated me as an advocacy piece, I want to also provide some policy recommendations during this presentation. So to begin with, just a really overview. I know somebody from the Laos, so I'm not going to say too much about this, but as Matt said, there's very little understanding of Laos. And the country is a very small, landlocked country in Southeast Asia with a small, relatively small number of people who are widely dispersed. And 70% of the population live in the forest. And in terms of the socio-economic development, it ranks around the bottom 30 to 50 country in the international ranking. And part of the reason, and I have just some numbers amidst here, but I'm not going to go over all of them. And also, in terms of corruption, it's one of the most corrupt countries in Southeast Asia, only slightly better than Cambodia and Myanmar. And it's doing business environment is also not so great. Even within this context, why is this issue so important? Well, first of all, as I said, forest is, if not the, it's definitely one of the most important resources in Laos. It covers over 40% of the land and supports 70% of the population. Those people who live in the rural areas are dependent on the forest for subsistence farming and for the collection of non-timber forest products. Some estimates show that the NTFPs account for 20 to 30% of the GDP, even though they are not showing on the national statistics. And also, some old data shows that the wood processing accounts for about a quarter of the manufacturing jobs within the country. So that's a pretty big portion. And despite this importance, the forest cover is declining in a very rapid rate. In the 1970s, I think there are over 70% of the country were covered by forest. Now it's down to over 40. And the rate of deforestation is about 5.5%, which is very fast. And also in the recent years, there are a number of increasing land concessions, plantation companies, which I will touch on later. And lastly, I think it's important because, as Matt said, there's very little attention paid to this country, even though the concession is becoming a very big problem within the country. And internationally, the so-called land grabbing issue has become increasingly catching international agencies' attention. And according to some statistics, 50% of the documented cases take place in Africa, but about a quarter of them happens in Southeast Asia. Most of the documented cases take place in Indonesia, Thailand, Cambodia, and Malaysia. But I just wanted to see, because Laos is such a low-key country, I thought it'd be interesting to bring some case about it. So my research objectives, as I said, my primary objective is to document a case to present how these things are all happening. And my second goal is to show the assessment. And in this presentation, I'm not going to talk too much about it, but they are also trying to get some policy implementation, policy recommendations. So here's a brief discussion of my methodology. I use mostly qualitative analysis methods. I just go to the village and talk to people because I can't openly say I'm doing a research, so mostly I just attend the meetings to kind of talk to people, spend about 2 weeks in the village just to get a sense of what people are doing and what they say. And also I interviewed a lot of legal experts and forestry scholars and the people who are working in these fields for 10, 20 years trying to get a sense of the legality of the issue. And also I analyzed the maps and the household survey data to get some quantitative elements. So just to give you, in order to talk about the land concession issue, I want to first give you a little bit of background information about the forestry policy of the government of Laos. The main policy is to modernize the sector. By modernizing the government mainly means three things. The first is to eradicate shifting cultivation by 2010, which is not happening. The second is the promotion of commercial tree plantation. And I think by some measure, it's already exceeded this target. And the third pillar is scientific management based on classification and delineation of the forest. I'm just going to talk about each one of them briefly. The first one is, and for those of you who are not familiar with shifting cultivation, it's a very old method of agriculture where villagers burn an area within the forest. They plant the rice or whatever crops, and then the next year they move to another area, they burn it, and then they leave the old plot the way it is to let it regenerate. And usually it's been being criticized for causing deforestation in rainforests, but more recent study have shown that if the population density is low and there's enough area for farmers to rotate, as long as then the system is actually very sustainable. they say that you need at least 7 to 10 years to allow the forest to fully regenerate, and then if you go back and do it again, then it won't cause too much damage to the ecosystem, so to speak. But the government has determined that this is one of the main reasons for the country's deforestation. The whole system is outdated, so they want to eradicate it. And how to do that? They basically have this land and forest allocation program, which was implemented in the early 1990s under the support of the World Bank and the German and the Danish. All these international aid agencies came in and drafted this program. It has all the good elements. It has an element of private land ownership. It had the element of community-based land management, as well as an element of local ownership and so on. So it's on paper, it's a great program, but as we will see in the actual case, because this program is targeting to terminate shifting cultivation, it has a lot of problems in the implementation phase. And the second pillar of the modernization of the forestry sector is commercial tree plantation. This is done by the Ministry of Planning and Investment. And as of 2008, there had already been 109 foreign companies granted with licenses to operate plantation within Laos, in addition to a lot of state-owned enterprises and a lot of local joint ventures. And there are 123 projects being awarded, and then this money is being, and this sector, this plantation sector, has been second largest foreign direct investment target within Laos, next to the energy sector. So a lot of foreign money has been falling into the country, into the plantation sector. And most of the money comes from Thailand, Vietnamese, and the Chinese companies. And of course, the timber that they produce are intended to be exported to these countries as well. So in a sense, there's a lot of money coming in. The government's earning foreign reserves, but very little money is actually get trickled down to the local communities. And the last piece of the pillar of the modernization is this scientific management. So by scientific, the government basically classifies the land into 8 categories, and the forest to 5 categories. So there are 13 different categories of land. And this is just an example of it. And then they define what this land is for. And there's a forest law that basically, I'd say, they have this forest law that defines how this land should be used. So if you actually look at the bottom, which I highlighted, is the land for plantation. By law, it says that only those forest land that is so degraded that there's very little chance they can actually naturally regenerate can be converted into plantation. Or you have to actually obtain the agreement from the local villagers if you want to use some other land from the village. So that's basically what the law says, and we want to look at this legality issue later. And for some reason this one is, so I'll just skip this. So now I want to look at the actual case study that I did. This village is located in central Laos in Savannakhet province, and it's in this one of those red districts. The red districts is are the 49 poorest districts within Laos that the government is determined as the priority development targets. So this village, Huasai village, is in the Ping district, and it has a population of 664 people. And the ethnic groups there are the Bru, the ethnic minorities. And the median age of the village is 15 years old. It's a very young village. And according to a survey conducted in January 2011, about 90% of the people live on subsistence agriculture, and 56% of the household conduct planted rice on the paddy field, and 68% on the sweden field. And when they were conducting this survey, I was in Laos. I was in DC writing this proposal, so I asked the organization to conduct some study about the food security, and it came out that 85% of the household said that in the previous year they had rice shortage, and the average month of rice shortage was about 5 months. And during this time, what they usually do is the village, they go to the village to collect mushrooms or bamboos or other vegetables, and then they trade it in the market for rice, or they can eat them themselves. And so when we were there, we're trying to conduct using GPS to map out the land to see how the land is actually being used according to the government classification. So as you can see, these are the areas that we classified. And one third of the area had already been taken by the plantation company. This company is, well, I'll talk about this a little bit later. And aside from that, about here's the fallow land and agriculture in the paddy. About 50% of the land is now used for agricultural uses. And the forest that villagers can actually go into to collect timber or to collect non-timber forest products are the production forest, which is the blue line, which accounts for only 6.3% of the total village area. And nobody actually knew this. There are already been so much land being taken by the rubber company. The rubber company was actually from Vietnam, the company name called the Quasigergo. And so we started doing our investigation on how the company actually gets started their projects. So here are the basic two investigative questions that I asked. What was the process of the land acquisition, and what was the outcome? So here's a timeline of events that we documented through interviews and through just listening to what villagers say during their village meetings. So apparently the company first appeared in the village in March 2008 with some government officials from the central government in Vientiane. They came in to conduct this land survey, but nobody was interviewed or consulted during the process. And then by the end of the year, the company came twice to ask the village chief to sign on a document that they say is a land contract. And during this meeting, the company asked for 600 to 800 hectares of village land in exchange for paying the village 9,000 for paying off the village debt. So what happened is that the year before, the village owned the state's electricity company $9,000 debt to connect electricity to their village. So they still own the money, and the state says basically if you don't pay the debt, then we're gonna cut off the electricity supply. So the company comes in and say, okay, we'll pay off this debt if you give us six to 800 hectares of land. And also they offer to pay some one-time rental fee to the villagers depending on the type of land. If it's a state land, they pay 60 cents. If the company has, if the individual has a title to the land, they will pay the person $6 per hectare of land that they acquire. So that was partly written in the contract according to the village headman. So the village chief eventually signed the document, and beginning the In 2009 through 2011, the company gradually expanded their area. So instead of taking a large chunk of land, they're still going to take this piece. And then a couple months later, they come in, oh, we're going to take this piece, and then we're going to take that piece. And then they start to hire people to work on the field and paid about $2 to $3 per day for their labor. When we were conducting our survey and interview, there appears to be some division of labor between men and women in terms of what kind of work that they do, but about equal number of people, both men and women, works in the plantation. And I think it was about one third of the villagers actually worked in the plantation for at least one day at some point during 2009 and 2011. And the funny thing was that, maybe I'll talk about this a little bit, but so as I said, at the time when I was in the village conducting this study, there already been one third of the area had already been taken by the company, but the villager had no idea how much land they got until they saw the map, because they did a little bit piece and here and there. So some of the problems that came out during our interviews. So first one is no written notice or consultation with the villagers at the very beginning, which was probably required actually by the government. It's actually written in the law that says that you have to consult, but they're not really doing any of these. And also some people were saying that the village chief was allegedly paid $6 per hectare for plantation land established within the village. And he was also later hired as a plantation guard by the company. So some people are complaining about these factors. And there was also no legal document retained in the village, no signed contracts. Nobody had to sign the contract. The villagers said the district government took the contract, and they said they're going to bring them a photocopy, but they never came back with a photocopy. And then there are also a lot of people are disputing over the compensation of the land. Some people have title, but this is just not officially recognized land title. So they were complaining about the companies taking their land without proper compensation. And the second question that I asked was, you know, what's the consequence? What kind of land are they actually taking? So this is a little bit confusing, but I try to explain it. This map, the base map, is the map we got from the PLMS, Provincial Land Management Authority, which is an entity primarily responsible for allocating land to foreign investors. And what they did is they basically mapped out the area. So these green areas are the one the government says this should be a protection forest that nobody should touch it. And these middle are the names of the families that they claim land title to these areas, which are officially recognized by the government. So the PLMA base come and say, okay, you know, these areas that we try to avoid these protection forests, the pink line are the areas they actually allocated to the company. And what really happened then is that this yellow line, I'm not sure if you can see it clearly, but these yellow lines are the areas that the company actually took, including this one. So if you see the map, they took a big chunk of the protection forest that's not supposed to be taken, and they pretty much relocated the whole population here in the village, which is about 25 families, I think. And also this area, it's marked as yellow. It's basically when before the government even started allocating the land, the company has already cleared that part. So that's what is yellow here. So basically it's just a map showing, you know, where the company actually took and what's happening. And if you compare the two map, the black line is the village boundary. And the pink line, again, is the allocation, and the green dots are the actual plantation area. And as you can see, actually within the village boundary, the government only allocated 480 hectares to the company, but the actual area taken was something like nearly 800. And because the villagers had no idea what the company was doing, they didn't know any legality of their activity, and they didn't even know what area the government actually allocated to the company. They had just no idea that a chunk of their land has already been taken. So here, and again, some of the issues that was raised. So the companies was not complying with the provincial land management authorities allocation, and they've cleared land without government authorization. And also they violated the forest law by clearing the protection forest for commercial plantations. And we are also unsure about the compensation that those relocated families received. But again, if we tie this to the earlier story, if there are a lot of people complaining, there might be some issues with that as well. But that's more of a speculation that we don't really have any strong evidence. So just a quick discussion of the impact. This is a satellite map that we got. And we again marked, this is the plantation boundaries. And technically, if you remember, the plantation can only be, and okay, so the red, deep red is the dense forest, and the green and the white part are those undegraded and bare land that is supposed to be allocated to the plantations. So technically, these are the parts that, you know, should be planted. But of course, the company comes in, they get the better soil, they want the good land, so they took those dense forest. And they've also, if you can see these green spots here, are the shifting cultivation plots. So if this big chunk of land is gone, then there'll be very little area for the farmers to do shifting cultivation, so they will have to move probably further into the forest, further, you know, degrading the land. And also a lot of people are arguing, you know, shifting cultivation is also bad for deforestation, but if you look at the impacts, they are very small plots. And the brighter the plot, the newer they are. And these are the darker ones, are the ones that's been sitting for maybe 4 or 5 years. They're already started to regenerate. So if you are actually managing this shifting cultivation in a good and a substantially long time span, the impact is actually very limited, as opposed to large-scale plantation where the entire area has been cleared now. And also in terms of economic impacts, there's a local and a national, and also short and a long-term. So in terms of short-term, when we ask people, you know, what's the main issue with this company coming, because a lot of people are complaining, and the main reason is the loss of NTFP, the non-timber forest products. As I said, you know, 5 months out of 12, you don't really have enough rice. So they need these products to trade for rice products, and they need them for as a source of nutrition. And also, some people complain about the loss of agricultural land, and also insufficient compensation. And interesting that we found out in our research is that even though 1/3 of the people who worked for the plantation at least for one day, there are only 8 full-time employees in the plantation. Most of the people only work there for a very temporary time. And then when you ask them, do they want to go back? Most of them say no. And you ask them why not? They say, you know, the wage is too low. The working conditions are very hard. Basically, you're working the clear land in the summer, then that you can't take any breaks. They give you like a 1 hour break for lunch. And besides that, you basically have to work for same hours a day versus if you work on your own fields, you're your own boss, you can take a break if you want to, you just work as much as you want. So you have very little freedom to decide how you want to do. And also a lot of people have issues with payment with the plantation managers who are mostly Vietnamese. So if you look at this, actually the interesting thing that I found when I was doing my research was I went to the fields, to the plantation, there was no single human being there. So we asked the village headman, you know, where are the people? They say it was in July. And then he said, you know, it's just a very busy season because the wet season, everybody's planting rice. So people don't have time to work in the plantation. So in the long run, if you're in the company, you don't have a labor working for you, what are you going to do? So you're going to bring people from outside. And that's one of the issues if you look at some other areas. A lot of Chinese companies are now bringing Chinese labor into Laos or into Africa because they can't really get enough local labor force to work for them. So in the long run, the labor migration can potentially be a big issue, especially with the rubber, because when rubber grows, you need people to tap the rubber every day. So it's unlike many other species, you cut them and you ship it out and then, you know, it's pretty much not, but rubber is more labor intensive product, like a labor intensive commodity. So there are potential issues with that. And also because the wage is so low, the, you know, one of the advocates for those plantations is that they can provide alternative livelihood for the local people so they don't have to work in the agriculture sector. They can, I mean, they don't have to work on subsistence farming. But because the wages were so, it's only like $3 or something, it's so low that the people don't say that it's not really enough. They basically have to work in the plantation during the dry season and they work on the field during the wet season. They have to do both work. But at the same time, there's very little land left for them to expand their agriculture. And from the national government perspective, first is they basically giving away these assets with very little return, almost no return. The land, I think the land rent is very low. It's only a couple cents per hectare. And there's no tax. Basically, they give these companies tax breaks. So if as long as you don't make money, you don't have to pay any tax to the government. That's why there's a lot of companies, they're expanding small plots slowly, because when you're growing, you are not making any money, you're making only investments. You only start making money when you start tapping the rubber. But when you still start making money, they basically put the money back into investing a new plot of fields. So on the book, at least, the company isn't really making any profit. So there's some tricks there that I in the long run, as I said, the labor shortage issue will be probably a big concern, both in and out migration. People in the village who can't find a livelihood and don't want to work in the village will have to migrate to Vientiane or Thailand, and some people from outside will have to come in to fill these labor needs. And also there's a concern about the financial viability of the plantations. I didn't get a chance to talk to this Vietnamese firm. They didn't respond, but I was able to speak to another plantation company who's doing work in the southern Laos. And that company has been losing $1 million every year because of the project delay. And he says that that's pretty much an issue across many companies who's investing in Laos. And also the World Bank study has shown that the tree planted in Laos have substantially lower quality than the industry standards. So a lot of them planted might not even grown into a commercially viable product. at the end. And also there are some issues, well, especially with the rubber, there is an issue of price uncertainty. Basically, these products are on the plant, these rubbers are planted on the premise that the Chinese demand for rubber will grow in the future, which is probably the case, but because there's so much rubber planted, especially in the north and in Vietnam, Thailand as well, in Malaysia, I think, that there is a concern of over supply down the road, so that might affect these companies' profitability in the future. So some of the policy implications, I can't really dig too much into it. The first is the land forest allocation program. It's a great program in terms of what it's, the how it's doing, but what in terms of what it's intended to do, I think it's a wrong focus. It has to maybe look more into the bottom-up side rather than trying to change people's behavior to force them abandon the shifting cultivation, because that's still the primary objective of the land forest allocation program. And the second one is the community education. People don't have the knowledge, so there's a limitation to what community-based forest management can do. When you come, foreign investors come in, they way more powerful, and they have basically the bargaining power to actually turn around all those projects that the international communities are trying to accomplish. And also, as we've seen, the whole process of land negotiation is completely opaque, that we don't really know how deals get constructed, how companies are actually taking these lands. Like, nobody knew where the companies were taking before we actually went in and trying to map this area. And then lastly, I think, you know, the forest sector, yes, it has to be modernized, but it has to be accompanied by investing more in the social capital and agricultural productivity, because right now there's no surplus of labor in the rural area. People are really busy just trying to feed themselves. So once you introduce the commercial crops, they have to do both, and they often cannot really manage that. So if you can increase agricultural productivity, you can actually free some people from their production, and they can actually be employed, but under the condition that the company actually pay decent wages that can support people's livelihoods. But that will also have to do with the level of education. If you remember my first slide, the average year of education among adults over 25 years old is only 4.6 years old. So the level of education is so low that even these people, they move out of their land, there's very little things that they can actually do. A lot of people, they migrate to the city and to Thailand as maid, or as like those very low level labor. So there are a lot of things that the government has to do in order to make this modernization scheme work. And that's the end of my presentation. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you so much, Karen. I'm just going to say just a couple of quick things I wrote down, and then we'll open it up for Q&A. First, I would just say that this, basically, I think really shows the strength and the need for qualitative research on the ground, because there are so many things you hit on. I wrote out a couple of them. Spirit forests. This is something I've done research as well in northern Thailand, and this is a very real thing. You know, there are a lot of ethnic minority areas, and you know, there are areas of the forest that are marked off by certain symbols, and that's a very real concern in these places. Swindling, slash and burn agriculture, which you talked quite a bit. Again, this is something that doesn't get a whole lot of attention in DC or sort of the mainstream FDI conversation, but this is an enormous issue in much of Highland Southeast Asia, so I'm glad that you keyed in on it to the extent that you did, the facts and the lack of legal documents. Again, you know, we can sit here and, you know, craft policy recommendations and talk about best practices, but, you know, a lot of it doesn't have a whole lot of bearing on how things actually work. So if people don't abide by contracts, or if, again, people in the village are completely left out of the loop, you know, contracts and all of this doesn't, it just doesn't reach, you know, to the ground level. I think that's it. Oh, also the issue of debt and this public debt, you know, people, leadership, trading off sort of with backroom deals with foreign companies to pay off debt, and, you know, how does that trickle down? Do people in his or her village actually see any of that? You know, these are all, I think, you know, I'm glad you touched on all these. These are things that very rarely come up, you know, in anything I hear in D.C. But, you know, more than a lot of things that are talked about here, this is how actually life is lived in places like southern Laos. So I'm really happy that, you know, you highlighted the things that you did. I would also just say that I realized as I was sitting here that I completely forgot to introduce you, because I rushed here from a meeting that ended about 30 seconds before this started, so I apologize for that. You all have her flyer, the flyer with her bio on there, but Karen Mo is one of our second year international development studies students who will be graduating, I think, next month?
Yes, next month.
Probably next month. And yeah, I would say, you know, you have joined a long list of our alums. We have the Seeger Center has given 164 students $1.7 million over the last 10 years to conduct research or language training in Asia. And so I think, and you are the first who's done something in Laos, so we're happy about that. So I'll leave it at that, and I think, I don't have a watch on, but I'm sure we have a little bit of time for Q&A. So we'll just sit down and have a conversation. Anyone have a question to start?
I have a question.
If you could identify yourself.
Sure, my name is Cambria Hambering. I'm with the State Department. Yeah, thank you so much for your talk. And I just had a question. I've traveled through Southern Laos, and I've seen those village maps. And you come into a village, and they have a map, and it's so confusing.
Yes.
And you're trying to figure out, and just the process. What do you have any sense of what the process is like for setting up those maps? Like, do the villagers get to say, This is my farmland, mm-hmm. This isn't, or does the government send representatives in from the capital mm-hmm. who do surveys and then say, we think this is how it should be allotted?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. In Laos, for better or worse, the government have very little capacity to do all these things. So the land and forest allocation program that I touched on is almost entirely developed and enforced by international donors. The Germans are the largest in this area, and the World Bank, and a lot of Nordic countries are contributing a lot of money on these things. So in Laos, there's one slide that was like little symbols that didn't show up, but that's the procedures. The government actually have a set of procedures that they have to follow, and they have 9 steps, and they identify that at every step, you have to have a local consultation. So in the area, there are areas where the government officials actually goes in to just spend like half a day and just craft a map. But there are also a lot of maps are developed by these donors. So the donor maps are actually way more well developed, so to speak. So what we did in this project, we just have like a handheld GIS device. We worked with some village people, whoever is available. So you ask them, you know, what's this area? How do you use this area? So they say, oh yeah, this is, we don't touch this. But the problem with these things is villages, because they do this sweating cultivation system, there's no static picture of this forest, because once you create a map, it's like a snapshot of something that's moving dynamic. There's an area they might cultivate now, it looks like a degraded forest, for example. But that's the area they used to be trees, and they might come back 10 years after to plant something on it again. But when you are trying to take a snapshot picture of it, then that looks entirely like a degraded forest. So in the government, that's the area that we can actually allocate plantations on it. So there's a certain dynamics to it, and also people don't really understand these concepts because it was created by international donors. It was like they have 13 different categories that the people just don't really understand. And you have to translate it into Lao language, which doesn't really exist in the first place.
Hmm.
So people, for example, conservation and protection, you say, oh, this is conservation, this is protection.
Mm.
And they can't really see the difference.
Okay, I'm going to go in and collect my right now.
I have a question. You said that the people, local people, villagers, are not very well compensated for
mm-hmm.
the land.
Yeah.
And plus, you know, their land is taken away, mm-hmm. you know, given to the companies. How can they complain? How can they fight against, mm-hmm. you know, the
yeah.
companies?
I think...
Like, can they complain to the higher authority or something like that, to government?
Yeah. While we were interviewing people, there were few families actually complained to the district's authority. But then the district authority, I think, dismissed these cases. And I think people have a very little understanding of the legal rights that they actually have. Like if you look at the law, the forest law and the land law says, here are your rights, but people don't really know any of these things. So oftentimes they say they complain not because it's their rights, but because they feel like they get less than their neighbors. So that's usually the reason that they go complain.
Mm-hmm.
Some people directly complain to the company, but I think there's an overall lack of. I remember only two cases that happened. I don't think they got any extra from the company. But also in Laos, I think the village chief have quite a lot of authority. So a lot of times when the village chief says mm-hmm. something, then you kind of have to comply.
Yeah, also don't forget that Laos is a communist country.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's...
Yeah, as Velas yes, yeah. mentioned, that it is. So it is very, still very centralized
yeah.
in terms of the government structure.
I mean, what did you find, or what do you know about people being essentially forced off their land? I mean, what degree of force is there, or expropriation,
mm-hmm.
or also violence? I mean, have people been killed either over their land, or if people are complaining, you know, are there repercussions?
Yeah. There's complaint, but compared to many other places, I think I don't actually heard for the whole time I was there any violent cases, not like Cambodia or Thailand, where the farmers actually, you know, actually protest. In Laos, it's very quiet, and I think that that's part of the reason why it's always been overlooked. I think people do complain, like I said, they complain to the village headman, and then they may complain to the district authority, but that's pretty much it.
Mm-hmm. And I know you study on a very specific
mm-hmm.
case,
yeah.
but in general, in Laos, how much land so far has been leased?
Mm-hmm.
To the foreign investors?
I think the latest data that I have is 150,000 hectares. That was a study by GIZ on 2008. But again, these are rough estimates because these companies, what they do is in the forest law, it depends on how much how large your concession area is. If it's above 30,000, you have to go get the National Assembly's permission. If it's between, I think, 5,000 to up to like 15,000
mm-hmm.
something, it's by the provincial government authority. And then below, you just need to talk to the district authority. And what happened is they signed these agreements. For example, the company that I spoke to, they have this agreement of 8,600 hectares within Savannakhet province. they have this agreement with the government, and the government draw the map for them, but they don't really follow the map. So nobody really knows overall in the country how much land has been taken. We only have estimates based on how much land that the government allocated to the companies. Like, you remember the two maps that I showed?
Mm-hmm.
One is the area government allocated, and the other is the company actually took. But they're not quite the same. And I don't really know exactly how much land has already been taken, but the best estimate is 1,500, 150,000, yeah.
Yeah. And also you talked about the Vietnamese rubber.
Yeah, the Vietnamese rubber.
Also use the, import some Vietnamese worker because, a lot of people don't want to work in a rubber plantation.
Yeah.
And do you actually see the Vietnamese worker? Talk to them?
Yeah.
How many of them? Or most of them? Most of the workers are Vietnamese or Laotian or half or half?
At this point, most of the workers are Laotian. But as I said, when I actually visited the plantation, there was no single human being there. So nobody was actually working. The village headman told us that when they first came, they had about like 8 Vietnamese managers. But these people are not really doing any labor. They hired Lao people through some Lao recruiters. So they hired a Lao person to recruit labor for them. And different recruiters have a little bit different recruiting system.
Were the recruiters local, or were the recruits from the local area, or were they from all over?
In the study that we did, at the very beginning, most of the recruits are from the local area. But as I said, a lot of people, they started working, but then they just quit the job. So chances are they might start recruiting people from elsewhere, but I don't have any evidence for that. I think there are 2 people who are from neighbor village that we came across.
I have a quick question.
Yes.
So,
could you identify yourself?
Oh yeah, my name is Ashley Dillon, and I'm also a student at the Elliott School. So in terms of the companies that are coming in and running these tree plantations, I was just wondering, is it mostly private companies, or is there any other sort of investment interest in these lands? In the form of, conservation funds or international donors who want to help preserve the land, or even climate change advocacy groups.
The ones that I put up, anything that go through the Ministry of Planning and Investment are private companies, so there are 109 private companies that applied. In terms of donor projects, the ADB, the Asian Development Bank, and the World Bank are the 2 largest donors in this area. ADB had a project in 1994, and the World Bank had a project in late 1990s till now. The project's been running for 10 years. They're both forestry projects. I can't say that they're very successful, especially with the ADB projects. It kind of failed miserably.
Because they approached it from the large scale?
Yeah, exactly.
And your findings suggest is that really they should have done it more from the ground up.
Exactly, more from the ground. Exactly. Yeah.
Act with and help grow the trees.
Yeah, exactly. There are certain issues with the smallholder models as well. The main problem in Laos is that the people don't have the labor to actually attend their own plots. They're just really busy working with their field. And for rubber, it's not something that you can get return right away. It's not crop that you grow this year and you can actually get something out of it the year after. You have to like constantly invest for 10 years before you can actually generate any cash income. So for the local people, that's a lot of investment of their time. But the time they spend on the plantation is something that they can't do on their own field. So that was one of the main reasons, in Laos at least, those smallholder models are not very sustainable and not very successful.
Because they can't get the financing?
Not finance, the labor.
labor?
Yeah, because if you're a smallholder, your family of, you know, two parents and six kids, the parents are working on the fields and they feed the kids. They don't really have excess time, the time to attend to the rubber. And that's why if you look at the trees grown, I think the World Bank study showed that they're just too thin and they grow like actually smaller, like it grow like slower than the normal tree
should be growing.
Exactly, they are not really taking care. They don't have the time to care for it, and they don't really. And they also, I think, lack some knowledge about taking care of these things. Because, I mean, I'm not an expert, but there are a lot of work that you have to do, especially when the tree is young. You have to take care, like you have to weed every day or every other day, or have to apply fertilizers and do all these things. So that's one of the issues.
I have another question. I see some trees there on, on the pictures. Also, you say that you know, the Vietnamese company expand its plantation into the protect forest. I just wonder what happened to the trees. The companies cut them down and take them to Vietnam, or what do you do with that?
Yeah, this is not really a logging, so I don't really, this is not like a logging company, so I don't really know what the company did with the trees. My guess of reading a lot of studies is that they might have, because every province have their own processing facilities that's been underutilized. So my guess is they might have just sold these things, because for these plantation companies, this tree value is less important than their, it's not their real business, their main business, so to speak. So I'm not exactly sure how it happened, but they might have just sold this to the local processing plants.
I just got 3 minutes, maybe one or two more questions.
I have a question. This might be outside the scope of your talk, but you know, the presentation, while really interesting, is also kind of depressing. I mean, it seems like this shifting agriculture pattern just has no future given the direction the government is going in. Did you, when you were there, maybe in your research, have you found any models of development that you think, you know, have been successful or are applicable for, especially for these rural populations, which, as you say, are so concerned about feeding themselves, they don't have time for some of these smaller scale programs?
Yeah, I think one thing that would be really helpful is really to help them increase agricultural productivity, because at this point they're really engaging in subsistence farming.
Sorry, I guess I don't quite understand what you mean by that. So they've got their own personal plots.
They got their
plots. To make those more productive.
Exactly, to make them more productive, so then the same plots that there are things that you can do to make the rice more, the rice yield higher. I can't show the pictures, but the way they plant the rice is, well, first of all, you know, in the rice farming, there are certain techniques that you can use, but they are not really applying these things. So there, if you can improve the agricultural productivity, well, first of all, you can free people's time of doing these things, and then maybe they will be able to sell these products in the local markets. There are certain things you can do before you can actually introduce those, like cash crops or, you know, the plantation models. And I think, yes, plantation is important, and I think to some extent it's inevitable, but it's sort of like against the people's will. Like, they don't really want to work in the plantation. They want to attend their fields and actually, you know, more, it's not like more the same, but it's people have their idea of how they want to live. So I think if we could pay a bit more attention to that aspect, it would be, it'd be more interesting, I mean, in more useful for them. And also, I think to some extent the pace of changing is too fast for people to actually adjust. The country, I think, is growing at 8 to 9% in the last 3 years, which is
population.
No, the
GDP.
The GDP growth. Yeah, it's very impressive, but at the same time, it's at the macro level, because these companies are investing, so it shows on the accounting, but there's really very little benefits right now on the ground.
I take the last question then.
Okay.
So one of the maps you showed, it was basically the density of forests, so the deep red versus mm-hmm. lighter red. Mm-hmm. You explained that the lighter red is probably from swiftly maybe a few years in as mm-hmm. the earth returns, you know, back to fertile mm-hmm. soil that could be planted again. And I wonder, I know that in the case of northern Thailand, which I'm more familiar with, I know that the government uses ethnic minority groups in particular, but also villages, as they scapegoats for swindling and saying, you're destroying the land.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And, you know, this land is no longer usable, and basically uses that an excuse to penalize whether mm-hmm. to move people out of this land so they can then, you know, use it as a concession to give to a mm-hmm. foreign company or something like this. I mean, do you have any, I don't know, do you have any sense of, and it's happened in Laos where basically do they accept and realize that swindling is not a destructive thing? Or mm-hmm. they use it to sort of advance their agenda?
Yeah. I think the governments have this, their idea of what modernization is, as I said. You know, swindling in their mind is a backward technology, it's a bad thing. So the government is pretty much similar to Thailand, that they have an idea that you have to abandon the Sweden if you want to, so quote unquote, develop. But not like Thailand, the Lao government is still relatively weak, for better or worse. So it doesn't really have power to enforce policy, but it doesn't really also have the power to really like force farmers to move. So it's more of, in my mind, using this plantation company by giving this concession. It looks more like the concession companies, the plantation companies are trying to push people out of their land through small bribery kind of thing. And the government doesn't seem to me have a lot of involvement in these kind of land deals. They draw the land and they just leave it in to the company. They do whatever they do. The government doesn't really know what's going on and they don't really care.
Speaking of bribery, did you have actually, you have any evidence that, like, did you speak what the village aid?
Mm-hmm.
Did he take any bribery from the company or?
Yeah, that's
did
one thing.
Proof that?
There's no proof to that.
Okay.
Yeah, that's just a hearsay among the villagers. Okay. Some people were complaining that, you know, the village chief got paid by the company somehow.
Yeah.
It's just a hearsay. We don't really know what's really going on. And I didn't really get the chance to talk to the company either.
And did you talk to the village aid?
Yes, I spoke to the village, but I can't really ask
you
that question. Yeah, it's a bit sensitive to ask.
Okay, well, I'm sure you'll be wrapping up for a few minutes if there's another question or so, mm-hmm. but clearly this was money well spent by the Seeker Center. It was a great study, and congratulations.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Thank you.
So again, I didn't hear you say